Appreciate the sermonette. I think it kind of fits in. There's some things that really do apply to the sermon as well. Most of us are just everyday people. We live, I think, common, uneventful lives. We probably think nobody notices those lives, perhaps nothing special at all. But history seems to be closing in on us. That's a view from my easy chair in Wahlberg, North Carolina. Eventful times may lie ahead of us. We just don't know. It's really hard to tell exactly where we are in the scheme of things. Perhaps things will drag on for decades to come. Doesn't seem that way, but perhaps the straw will be added that will break the camel's back, finally. And tumultuous times may follow. Perhaps God will finally say, it's time. Times called the beginning of sorrows or the days of vengeance, tribulation, national calamity, national captivity, and then where do you stand then? Will there be a time when people really do notice your life, where they really do notice? Or will things just continue on like they always have? We really need to be prepared for things either way. So I'm going to mention several things for a few minutes. You might wonder, surely you will never wonder, how these are all going to fit together, but indulge me if you would. In my mind, all of these things really do lead to us, to you, to me. I think these are stories that God would like for us to know. Eventually, our stories will be written, but history really can teach us so much. You may not know the name John Moffat. Not James Moffat. James Moffat wrote a translation of the Bible, I believe, but John Moffat. But you probably do know the name of the German World War II battleship Bismarck. Actually, people my age and older know the name of that ship. People younger, I asked my kids, they didn't know very much about the Bismarck. My grandkids really did not know very much. But it was the biggest battleship the Germans built in World War II. It was a battleship that sunk Great Britain's biggest battleship called the Hood in the Battle of Denmark Straits. Now, those were desperate times back in May of 1941. So we're talking about World War II. The United States at that time had not entered the war. Pearl Harbor would not happen again for a few months. It happened in December of that year. Northwestern Europe was already overrun. Italy was in the Axis powers with Germany and Japan. France was occupied. Spain was neutral, although they really sided with the Germans. And Britain at that point was really mostly alone, fighting alone. I think we were supplying them material, but they were fighting alone. So were those desperate times? A demented dictator was on the march, securing victory after victory. He was aimed at world domination. I don't think we can really imagine what it was like to live in London or Liverpool at that time when, you know, you had to take to the bomb shelters regularly. Things were, I think, closing in on them. They were alone. I think those were desperate times. So we know of God's promises to Abraham and to his descendants, to Ephraim and Manasseh. So sometimes I take for granted everybody knows that, but I've found out that really not everybody knows these things. So I just want to read some scriptures. Genesis 12, verse 2. God said to Abraham, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all families of the earth shall be blessed. So that's really a dual promise, as we understand it. The promise of the Messiah, for sure, in that last line, all families of the earth will be blessed, certainly, by the Messiah eventually. But also the promise of a physical nation that would be a blessing to planet Earth. And that would be according to God's purpose. And I think that goes a long way to account for you sitting here today in freedom and in peace. Genesis 35:11, once again, God said to him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings will come from your body. So we understand, I believe, the final fulfillment of that lies in the rise of the United States of America, the British Empire. That's a great promise from God, a promise to be filled as the end times approached. So the promise, this birthright promise, includes Americans, it includes Brits, Aussies, Kiwis, Canucks, and truly our nations have been blessed, I think most especially since World War II. And our nations have been a huge blessing to other nations, to the world, no matter what some might claim today. That has been a fact. If you look at history, that's the truth. But there were key moments along the way. Turning points, intervention by Almighty God to make sure those blessings came to pass. And for the most part, God used human beings, people, to make sure those things actually happened to carry out his will. So the Bismarck had been damaged during that battle that sunk the Hood, the Battle of Denmark Straits. One fuel compartment had been struck, and they were unable, therefore, to access the fuel in that compartment. So the range of the battleship was greatly diminished. So it needed to head to port for repairs. And so it could go back to Norway, where they had, the Germans had a facility there, or it could go to France. But the Allies lost track of the battleship. They didn't know for sure where it was going. The British knew they needed to get to the battleship or to the Bismarck while it was on the open ocean. Once it got close to land, then the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, could protect it. So they had to find the Bismarck out on the open sea. So the desperate search was on after that Battle of Denmark Straits. After 3 days, the Bismarck was sighted. An American reconnaissance aircraft spotted an oil slick from the leaking fuel compartment and followed it and discovered the huge battleship. But only one British battle group was close enough to intercept the Bismarck before it gained port in France. So it was headed to France. In that battle group of ships was an aircraft carrier. The aircraft carrier was named the Ark Royal. But don't think of the gigantic aircraft carriers that we know about today. This aircraft carrier only had 15 swordfish airplanes on its deck. So swordfish were an old bi-winged aircraft. So two wings, one on top, one on the bottom, that could carry only one torpedo each. So toward the end of the day, on May 26, 1941, 15 swordfish were sent off to attack the Bismarck. So only 13 were able to engage the German ship. The weather in the North Atlantic was actually horrific. Rain, squalls, high winds, high seas, low clouds, terrible visibility for an airplane, but these were brave young men fighting on both sides. So years ago, I think you probably remember Marlon Kime. So Marlon Kime told me this story. He said, look, it was the last torpedo that hit the Bismarck. And I thought, really, the last torpedo, that's the finger of God. And so in my mind, I pictured a pink sky, you know, about sundown. I pictured a big, dark silhouette of a big battleship and a little swordfish buzzing around, dropping its torpedo and heading off. And then the torpedo, I thought, would hit the rudder, and then the ship would be destroyed. That's not exactly how it happened. So these little planes were like pesky flies to the huge warship. They actually took off and found the wrong ship. They found a British ship, and they started attacking the British ship. And the British ship took evasive maneuvers, and they finally figured out that they were attacking a friendly ship. None of their torpedoes did any damage, but what they learned was that the detonation mechanism was set wrong. So a lot of their torpedoes were going off just when they hit the water, where they needed to go in the water and make their way toward the ship and then detonate on contact. They had to go back to the Ark Royal, change out, get new torpedoes, but also change the detonation mechanism. Not using the right word there, but hopefully you get the idea. And then they took off again to find the Bismarck. So these little planes were like pesky flies to the huge warship, slow moving. They had to retreat into the clouds to gain the right angle and then come down and attack. The air was filled with flak from the German anti-aircraft guns, but none of the swordfish were shot down. So you can find some articles written about why couldn't they shoot down those swordfish. So maybe we would have an idea of why none of those planes were shot down. It's a mystery to the world. But one by one, these little biplanes, as they were able to get into position, dropped their torpedoes. Three torpedoes actually hit the heavily armored ship. The first two did very little damage, but the last one, dropped by a pilot named John Moffett, just before sundown, managed to hit the steering mechanism, and the rudder was jammed to port. It was stuck. So crippled, that ship could only sail an erratic pattern. It could sail full speed if it wanted to go in a circle, but that's all. So I think it managed to try to go straight by using one engine at a time, something like that. It was the last torpedo. It was the finger of God. It was what Marlin told me. We can read, get the human side of these events. I looked for information. When Marlin told me that, I looked to see if I could figure out if he was really right. Was it the last torpedo? And I couldn't find anything about it. But when I started looking at it, I finally found a place where the battle was described. And it wasn't quite like I pictured, with a pink sky and calm sea. Moffett was flying his plane in low. The weather was terrible. The Bismarck deck was pitching and heaving 60 feet, 60-foot seas. But the anti-aircraft fire was coming fast at Moffett's little aircraft. The German gunners were doing their best, you know, in their conditions. And Moffett had to force himself to hold his course and get close enough to drop the torpedo. And then he was just about ready to drop it when his navigator, sitting behind him, said, "Not yet." And he looked back, and his navigator was hanging out of the aircraft, his backside in the air, looking at the waves. So he had to drop his torpedo in the trough between the big waves. If you hit the top, it might bounce off and go a different direction, or might head to the bottom of the sea. So he had to hold his course even longer. Then finally he heard his buddy say, "Okay, do it." And so he pulled the lever or pushed the button, whatever it took, and dropped their payload. And then off they went to find the mothership. They never saw what happened. It was only in 2010 that Moffett got the word that it was his torpedo that had crippled the Bismarck. 69 years later, they finally figured it out. He was 91 years old then. He would also fit here very nicely. So the military historians had to interview all the different pilots. They had to interview the surviving Germans that were rescued and figure out who was in the air at what time, who dropped their bomb when, because a pilot might drop his torpedo, then he'd go off in the clouds, and another pilot would see if there was a plume of water at the side of a ship. So they finally figured out that it was him whose torpedo hit the Bismarck. So I think God reached down and touched those in that little swordfish who were flying on that day. And history was made. History was changed. It was directed by God, and England survived. It wasn't the only thing that helped England survive, but it was pivotal. That's just one story, but that was a big story. Maybe you can hum the tune, "Sink the Bismarck." You know that tune? By Johnny Horton. I can't. My parents had a record. It was a greatest hits record with various artists, but I think the fourth song on that record that we had a hi-fi in the living room, and the fourth song was "Sink the Bismarck." So I knew that song from childhood, and that's all I knew of that battle until I started studying to see what happened. The song actually doesn't get it right. It doesn't tell the right story. But it was a great song. I'll bet you some of you know it. I'm not going to sing it for you. As a child, I knew that we won the war. And I knew that was a good thing. I was happy about that. Weren't we all? Or have some of us forgotten? And I grew up in a wonderful country after that. I never had to fight in a war. I guess I was born at the right time. I never was asked to shoot at anybody. As far as I know, nobody's ever shot at me. Not yet. There was the American Civil War. When I was born in 1954, it had been over. The Civil War had been over for 89 years. Only 89 years. One person's lifespan between my life and the Civil War. Kind of incredible. World War II had been over for only 9 years. We know the good guys won World War I, World War II. We know the right people won the Civil War, right? And we've all benefited. We still do benefit. And of course, we read the history that was written here. It was written by the winners. And then people write books and people make movies, and that's how history kind of is solidified. But we're in the Church of God. And I think we understand that that history, as we've learned it, is mostly correct. The Civil War was a close contest. In the beginning, the South did well. Maybe a lot of you know a lot more than me about it. There were victories for the South in some major battles. Then there were reverses. But the pivotal battle and the largest battle was at Gettysburg. It was a huge battle, 3-day battle, 51,000 casualties combined, killed, wounded, missing during the Battle of Gettysburg. So I'm not an expert on that battle. Some might disagree with my conclusions, but history is written again by the winners. But on the second day of the battle, July 2nd, 1863, a skirmish occurred in the very far left of the Union lines in a place called Little Round Top. So maybe some of you have been there. I've not visited there myself, but it's a small mound far to the south, but it was to the left of the Union lines. At first, Little Round Top was not defended, but General Meade, who was present there, and he was over all of the Union Army, he sent his chief engineer, that would have been General Warren, to check out the lay of the battlefield. The Union forces occupied the high ground. They got there first. That was a big deal. They occupied the high ground. They got there a day ahead of General Lee's army. Those armies did not really know where the other armies were. There were no satellites. There were no aircraft to scout things out. All the scouting had to be done on horseback. Pretty dangerous activity. But they just knew they were close by each other. But General Warren recognized the importance of Little Round Top immediately, because if the Union forces were to get up that hill and outflank, Confederate forces were able to come up the hill, outflank the Union forces and get behind them, then everything would be thrown into disarray. So did the entire war boil down to this little hill in Pennsylvania? Some think possibly so. Lots of things going on there, lots of strategy. The Europeans were waiting. They could have come in on the side of the South if they had won at Gettysburg. So lots of things could have happened. But once General Warren saw that, Union troops were rushed to Little Round Top. And as they arrived, the Confederates were already advancing up the hill. But defenses were hastily arranged, and the fighting was fierce. On the very far left, actually in the saddle between Little Round Top and Big Round Top, was placed the 20th Maine Regiment, commanded by General Joshua Chamberlain, and they were told to hold their positions at all costs. So Abraham Lincoln gave his most famous Gettysburg Address about 4 months later. You know how it goes. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men were created equal. So it was actually a nation that was conceived in the mind of God a long time ago. We read in the book of Genesis that from the seed of Abraham would come a nation and a company of nations. I think it's no wonder, as we look back on it, that the great nation, fulfilling the promises made to Abraham, would be conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So was God's hand there on Little Round Top, working his miracles in that little thin line stretching far out to the left. That line that was assaulted repeatedly and gave way and folded back like a door on a hinge, but never gave way. And then when they were finally out of ammunition, they mounted a bayonet charge, and they charged down the hill and finally got the tired and the thirsty and parched rebel troops to surrender. The very thin end of the line, manned by flesh and blood, frightened, determined, courageous human beings from the state of Maine. I believe it was the finger of God once again. Abraham Lincoln concluded his Gettysburg Address this way. He said that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth. We might wonder, I wonder if it's perished from the earth at this point. That's a different subject, but worth a little bit of conversation. But about 150 years ago, the Union was saved. It was preserved. The war wasn't over, but the tide was turned, disaster was averted. And as we look back, it's been a wonderful nation that through its fall, through its flaws, has continued to pursue the proposition that all men are created equal. And we've done better, I think, at that proposition than any nation on earth. Well, that's a fact not mentioned, once again, very much these days. Probably was not done as fast as it could have been, but the direction has been that direction. And it was this nation that God conceived and brought into being. Yet now we stand in perilous times when we are being torn apart once again. We stand in a nation that basically does not act or believe like we are created beings at all. We're a nation that, as a whole, I believe, rejects God's hand in our lives. We stand in a nation that doesn't seem to believe sin exists, but it is our sins that will be our undoing. We live in a nation that does not even know who they are. So where will you stand? Where and with who will God's hand be working at this time in history? In this time, we don't know how far ahead of us, but perhaps in your time. I'm reminded of a verse in the book of Esther. The Jews were in Persia, were being threatened with annihilation. And, you know, Queen Esther was in a position to possibly help, but not without risk to herself. And then Mordecai, you know, sent a message to her saying, "For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom or received her favored position at the king's side for such a time as this." So John Moffat surged forward in the face of heavy gunfire to drop his one torpedo. He was there when God was ready to use him. The soldiers from Maine and a few others who were scattered to their right did not break. They did not run away when history and the finger of God was there for them. Many of them lost their lives. Remember what we are told in the book of Romans. We are told, we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. So, brethren, we're not going to be called on to fight in a war. We're not going to sink a ship. We're not going to lead a bayonet charge. If we had to, it might be a pathetic-looking thing. But our faith is going to be challenged, and our opportunities of God's making are going to present themselves soon enough. So I go to South Carolina to speak once a month or so. I speak in Florence, South Carolina. I'm going to speak there next week. Or Columbia, South Carolina, or even over into Augusta, Georgia. But the very first time my wife and I were ever in Columbia, the other Columbia, one of the other Columbias, we stayed in a hotel in downtown Columbia. And so we arrived in the afternoon. And as I like to do in situations like that, I took off walking just to try to get the lay of the land. I didn't know where I was going. I just wanted to see what was there. So I made a big loop around, and I kind of located the University of South Carolina. And I could see their Gamecock football stadium way off in the distance. And as I headed back toward the hotel and started to head home, I saw an interesting little staircase off to the right, just about three steps into a shaded area. I couldn't tell what was up there, but it looked like a public staircase, so I went up those stairs, and after a little bit, I realized there was a large crowd of people there. Someone was speaking in front of a large building, and there were a lot of highway patrol officers there, and they were watching me pretty closely because I was just coming out of, I guess, sneaking up from the back side of them. Turns out I was at the state capitol building. It was about the time people were protesting the Confederate symbols on the South Carolina flag. So a lot of people were there. Some emotions were present there. And I have never been watched so closely by the police. But I didn't have any idea our hotel was so close to the state capitol. So I did a little exploring around the state capitol grounds. There are lots of displays there on the capitol grounds. Lots of monuments, lots of history there. And as I walked around, I discovered another large gathering in the front of the capitol at the same time. And this one was a lot happier. There was laughter, there was applause. But I have made it a point to visit that Capitol building every time we stay in Columbia. So much history is there. Toward the end of the Civil War, General Sherman marched down to Atlanta. You know that story? He burned everything in his path. He burned the city of Atlanta. Then he turned east and marched toward Savannah. He marched to the sea. He destroyed and burned everything in his path. It was very effective. War was taken to the people of the South in a big way. And then from Savannah, which I didn't know, from Savannah he turned and headed toward Columbia. I never knew that. Maybe you hadn't heard that either. I'd be surprised if you had. But South Carolina was where the embers of secession first started. There were radical people there in South Carolina. It was a hotbed. And it was there in South Carolina, at Fort Sumter, the first shots of the Civil War were being fired. So Sherman had good cause to head toward Columbia. So Sherman and his 60,000 soldiers were in Columbia for 3 days. They burned about one-third to one-half of the city at that time, and they burned the Capitol building. And the building I have come to enjoy has been built in its former shadow, very nearby. So many monuments on the grounds. A large statue of Wade Hampton. He was a South Carolina general in the Civil War. A statue of Strom Thurmond, I believe, who was the longest serving senator in our nation's history. I think it was 1954 to 2003, if I'm right, until he died. I think it was 8 terms in the Senate. There's an African-American memorial there I found fascinating. It's in stone relief. You have the history of the Africans in America, and it's really inspiring to see how they have come. It's really too bad that it ends. There might be more history to be added to that. There's something there, you know, there's nothing about having an African-American president on that memorial. It was built a little bit too soon. Lots of other memorials. There's a statue of George Washington there that was actually brick-batted by the Union troops while they were in town, broke his sword on that statue. It's still standing there on the steps of the Capitol. So I am from a place called Missouri, right? We don't have the history here that is there out in the East, and so I'm coming to learn a lot about the history out there. And I try to have an eye out to how God has worked. Revolutionary War, Civil War. So as you cross Gervais Street from where our hotel normally is, you enter the Capitol grounds, and you encounter there an elevated memorial to Confederate soldiers. It's front and center. Men who gave their lives to the cause of secession, and perhaps to a way of life they had always known, but one which could not continue. You see, God needed South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, Virginia, even Texas, right? In the Union, parts of this great nation. He needed the people in those states in the Union. a part of the nation, a vibrant, vital part of it. It was necessary, it was required before there could be this great nation that God promised to Abraham. Lots of great things would be accomplished through our great nation. You can begin by thinking about a home for the gospel and for the Church of God here at this time. But when I tour those grounds in Columbia, I begin to see a people through time. I see them through time as they see the need to erect a monument for something that's happened in their history, as they come to grips with what has happened. And I love standing at the foot of the Confederate Memorial. I hope you could go there and see it sometime. And reading the inscription, it's so telling. It's realistic. It's rational. And so I want to read that inscription to you. It's on the Confederate Soldiers Memorial. It says, "This monument perpetuates the memory of those who, true to the instincts of their birth, faithful to the teachings of their fathers, constant in their love for the state, died in the performance of their duty, who have glorified a fallen cause by the simple manhood of their lives, the patient endurance of suffering, and the heroism of death, and who, in the dark hours of imprisonment, in the hopelessness of the hospital, in the short, sharp agony of the field, find support and consolation in the belief that at home they would not be forgotten." So if that memorial's ever toppled or even protested, I don't know if it's been protested, but if that day comes, it'll be a very, very sad day for this country. Joshua Chamberlain of Little Round Top fame that I mentioned was at Appomattox Courthouse when General Robert E. Lee surrendered his army to General Ulysses Grant. And he was there 4 days later when the soldiers came and they laid down their weapons and piled them up. And this is what he wrote about his experience there. Joshua Chamberlain. "Before us in proud humiliation stood the embodiment of manhood, men whom neither toils and sufferings nor the fact of death nor disaster nor hopelessness could bend from their resolve, standing before us now, thin, worn, and famished, but erect, with eyes looking level into ours, waking memories that bound us together as no other bond. Was not such manhood to be welcomed back into a union so tested and assured? On our part, not a sound of trumpet more, nor roll of drum, not a cheer, nor word, nor whisper of vainglorying, nor motion of man standing again at the order, but an awed stillness rather, and breath-holding, as if it were the passing of the dead." So, once again, I come from Missouri. You know, we were a border state. It's a place that I love dearly. I assume you love it as well. My wife and I find a culture in the South. We live in the South now. The culture there is very warm. We enjoy it. It dates back from a long history. We read in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, of the history of God's people. You know how it goes. The beginning verses are about Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Rahab, David, Samuel, Gideon, and then at the end, we find these verses, verse 36. "Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were slain with a sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented." Verse 38, "of whom the world was not worthy." So the next chapter refers to these people here in the end of chapter 11 as a great cloud of witnesses. Witnesses for us, and also witnesses for those in their time who saw what they went through, what they endured, because they endured some very difficult things. They lost their homes. They were destroyed financially. They were chained like animals. Many lost their lives. But brethren, that is our heritage. Do you believe it? Do you realize it? Do you think about it? It goes on, "they wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth, And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. Through faith. Through faith. Faith that God would deliver them? Faith that they would not have to suffer? Not really. I think it was faith that God was watching. And as God watched, he approved of their conduct because it followed from their faith. Now, you heard a sermonette talking about obedience. Verse 40, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. So we can wonder, you know, what is that something better that God has for us? A church to meet with over a long period of time? Perhaps. The anointing of the Spirit of God for many years? Perhaps. Jesus said we would be hated by all nations for his name's sake. Is it that? Maybe. How will we do? In the very far reaches of the South Carolina Capitol grounds, beyond the Strom Thurmond statue by about another 50 yards, is the Women's Memorial. It was erected in honor of the women of the South who had to carry such a load. It was dedicated in 1912. I find it amazing and fascinating. I wonder if anybody reads these things. Of course, for anybody to read them, somebody has to write them. And the writers, are given the benefit of history and of hindsight and the knowledge of how things turned out, and they have time to hone their words until they get them just right. And their words come from the heart of a people who have been through some things together. So on the Women's Memorial, dedicated by the men of South Carolina, who appreciated what their mothers and their grandmothers went through, and who saw clearly their strengths and virtues, we find these words. So on the east face of the monument. And as I read these words, please keep in a mind out toward the things that may happen ahead of us. That's where my mind goes. So here's what's written on that monument. When reverses follow, excuse me. Very nice. When reverses followed victories, when want displaced plenty, when mourning for the flower of southern manhood darkened countless homes. So, brethren, these were widows that are being extolled. They were everywhere. When government tottered and chaos threatened, the women were steadfast and unafraid. They were unchained in devotion, unshaken in their patriotism, unwearied in ministrations, uncomplaining in sacrifices, splendid in fortitude. They strove while they wept. In the rebuilding after the desolation, their virtues stood as a supreme citadel, with strong towers of faith and hope around which civilization rallied and triumphed. So just if I could recount those words, unchained, unshaken, unwearied, uncomplaining, splendid, striving, virtues, faith, and hope. So is that a description of every single woman or widow from the South on every single day of the years following that devastation? Of course not. But does it describe the whole pretty well? I think it does. And does it describe a people with vision and courage and determination? I think so. Do my children and grandchildren read these things and consider the times in which they live? I don't think so. Are they ready for a different time, a difficult time? I fear not. But am I ready? Are you ready? I read the Bible and I wonder sometimes, why does God desire to have martyrs? What's the purpose? Because there is a great purpose, because they have been there. I know we all want to live peaceful lives. We want to live productive lives. We yearn for healthy, vibrant, active lives. I do. I think I desire that as much as anybody on earth. I love working for a living still. It's a great blessing to be able to work. I think most of you know that's true. I love trying to get better at what I do still. Still plenty of room for improvement. I love dealing with patients. I love dealing with employees most of the time. I love lots of things. You know, I look forward to meeting my great-grandchildren someday. No hurry, I guess, but someday. I love coming to church every Sabbath, hearing a sermon, being inspired, fellowshipping, many other things I love. My wife and I were at a restaurant not long ago, about probably 2 months, and there were a couple of tables with my patients there. And they actually smiled and waved, and we talked a little bit. So I went for about 3 years after we left Missouri and North Carolina, where I never saw one single person I knew when I went out in public, not one single person. Now in the small community of Wahlberg, which you've never heard of before, it's actually nice to be a part of something. Will there be a time when things have to change? Turn to Revelation 6. Revelation 6, verse 9. You know these verses. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" Then a white robe was given to each of them, and was said to them that they should rest a little while longer until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were completed. So the Church of God has been around for a couple of millennia now. I don't believe there have been very many times in history of the church when the church has enjoyed peace and freedom like we have today. And so many of us in the church live in this land of plenty and in this push-button world. But God is bringing a kingdom, and I don't think it's going to be ushered in quietly. And it's not going to be welcomed by the world. It's going to be a kingdom filled to the brim with righteousness. The world we live in does not like righteousness. And I think they're going to like it even less as time goes on. It is a world filled with darkness and not light. We read of a time when Satan is cast back down to earth, full of wrath because he knows he has but a short time left. We wonder, is that just around the corner? I wonder, has it already happened? The history of the Church of God is one of persecution, not peace. It's one of clinging to the truth in dangerous times or difficult times. You know, Jesus said, "Think not I come to bring peace." I believe we will come to a time when we'll be called upon to make a stand, when the finger of God will be on us. I hope we're enjoying this time of peace and plenty. There is no reason not to enjoy it. But I hope at the same time that we are preparing, and I hope we're overcoming, and I hope we are thinking, and I hope we're being very good examples to those who see us. I think of the sermonette, and I think of the things that we have to go through, the trials we go through, and people watch us go through trials. What better example of when could there be of when we actually go through those trials in a good way? We read of Abraham, Hebrews 11, "For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God." Abraham was not a martyr. Neither was Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, none of them. They were pilgrims in a world that was not godly. They never got to settle down. They found no place that really had good foundations. They found no place that was built around righteousness. Neither have we. The word martyr is only found two times in the New Testament. That's in two times in the King James Version, two times in the New King James Version. In most translations, it occurs zero times. It's from the Greek word martus, M-A-R-T-U-S, but most of the time that word is translated witness. And I think we could probably say that the word martyr is not really properly in the scriptures. The concept that we find is that God wants witnesses, examples. That's what's most important. But the concept of martyrdom is there. It's obviously there as well. Acts 22, verse 20. Paul Paul is saying there, "And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I was also standing by, consenting to his death, and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him." So that's Paul speaking, but most translations use the word witness instead of martyr. So Stephen was inspired by God. He spoke boldly. Most of Acts 7 is composed of words that Stephen spoke, and those words cost Stephen his life. Those words came from God, and Stephen was indeed a martyr. And he was killed according to God's will. But he was first, he was a witness. He was a very good witness. In Revelation 2, we read of the Pergamos era. Revelation 2, verse 13. We read, "I know your works and where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, and you hold fast to my name." They were being a witness. "And did not deny my faith." Once again, a witness. "Even in the days when Antipas was my faithful martyr." That's the same word. That means witness. "Who was killed among you, where Satan dwells." Martyrdom, yes. But first, a witness. So I've told you about some people that performed well in some clutch situations. John Moffat held steady in the face of fierce fire, his little swordfish plane being shot at, and he dropped his torpedo that turned out to be the Bismarck's demise. Men on the entire hill of Little Round Top, not just those from Maine, but those up on the hill from New York and Pennsylvania, held their ground under relentless attack, many losing their lives, others surviving to tell the story. All there because they believed in, as Abraham Lincoln termed it, the proposition that all men are created equal. And they believed in this nation. So they stood and fought. And God's will was accomplished. The nation was preserved, perhaps just by a whisker. Men fought and suffered, paid the price. Women also had to support and persevere and suffer and yet work to make sure life continued. It took everyone. So this sermon is given with the proposition that we are called by God to be a special people. And also that we are in the end times. The very end, I don't know. God does know. Will the end really come? We know that it will. We must not be scoffers. We know scoffers will be around. We must not be those people. We just must be ready. Will God want a witness at the end? Well, he's wanted a witness all along, you know, starting with John the Baptist. That was John the Baptist's main job, to be a witness of the coming Messiah, right? Then he was martyred. Then Stephen, he gave a very strong witness to his peers. He was martyred. Paul tells us of others who are unnamed, prison, martyrdom. And I believe at the end, God will have flesh and blood witnesses once again. They will be there to make people think. And I believe that's why we read so much of what we read about the saints at the end time. So are you ready to be a good witness? Have you, by someone's design, come to the church of God for such a time as this? Revelation 12, verse 10. Revelation 12, verse 10, "And then I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren who accused them before our God day and night has been cast down." So we read of salvation, we read about God's kingdom and the power of his Christ, and we read of a people being accused before God day and night. I figure that's us. Does Satan have things to say about us? Most likely so. But there is a problem with Satan and his attitude, and that problem is that God is on our side, and Christ is there as our advocate. And there is the Spirit of God that is there to lead us into righteousness. Relentlessly, you are being led to righteousness. No matter what Satan may scream, about you or about us. Verse 11, they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. Real overcoming. By the blood of the Lamb. Unleavened bread after Passover. And a witness to other human beings with frailties just like us. And it goes on and says, and by the word of their testimony, once again, a witness. And they did not love their lives to the death. And that is, in fact, martyrdom. And it's in the future. These verses are in the future, a time ahead of us. Coming to some people who start out by being very good witnesses. Revelation 20, verse 4, I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. This, of course, the first resurrection, a better resurrection. I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God. They will have been a shining example following the word of God, even against popular thought. Who had not worshipped the beast nor his image and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. These are end time people. These are people that lay ahead of us still. We don't know how far in the future. The mark of the beast is an end time event. And we see top billing. Look at it. Top billing in the first resurrection is given to some end time people who go through some very difficult times. And it says they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. So some will be martyred. Not everybody. Some will be in supporting roles. I suppose like the women in the South in the late 1800s who were striving while they wept. Not being destroyed, but rather courageous. Hated by the world, but friends and companions of those who pay the ultimate price. Hated by the world, that's our time. Loyal to them, loyal to God. And I suppose many will be ruined financially, their goods and their possessions expropriated or stolen. So get ready. I'm always amazed at what I find in Daniel 7. I don't think we really read it that much. Maybe you read it. Daniel's given a dream of a lion, a bear, a leopard, and then a fourth beast, dreadful with iron teeth. And Daniel's attention is drawn to that fourth beast. Verse 17, those great beasts which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So that's the big picture. God gives Daniel the big picture, the overview, good news, wonderful news, fantastic news. Verse 19, then I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast. He's still looking at the fourth beast, which was different from the others, exceedingly dreadful with its teeth of iron and nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces, trampled the residue with his feet. And the 10 horns that were on its head and the other horn which came up before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words. Verse 21, I was watching and the same horn was making war with the saints, against the saints, and prevailing against them. Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. We see this horn making war with the saints and prevailing, apparently right up to the time that Jesus Christ returns. Still good news. Judgment was made in favor of the saints. They will possess the kingdom forever and ever. Thus, he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the others. He's still looking at that fourth beast, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings, which shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. He shall be different than the first one, shall subdue 3 kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High. He shall persecute the saints of the Most High. Other translations say, wear out the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and laws. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time, probably dual. 1260 years through the Middle Ages, the church had to endure that. And then at the end, 1260 days, 3.5 years at the end of the age. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion. Consume and destroy it forever. and the kingdom and dominion, the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions will serve and obey him. So once again, very good news. So what is all this talk about persecution of the saints? It seems to be scattered throughout the Bible, and especially when we talk about the end time. We also read the words of Jesus in Luke 21. Jesus said, "But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, the cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the earth." A snare, a trap with no escape. "Watch therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man." So Jesus himself talks about escape. We know God can make anything happen. And we know God has put all of these words in the Bible. They're all true. So how should we think? What should be our mindset? So I can only give you my advice. I'm no prophet. And I don't know the timing of things. I'd love to know the timing of things, but I don't. Many of us may go to our graves before things get difficult. I think I heard that in a sermonette as well. Protected from a difficult time. Others might not. One thing I do believe, it's true and applicable to every one of us, we need to be good witnesses. We need to be good examples. We need to be lights that shine brightly, and we need to be prepared to do that. I think it's obvious that that is what God wants. It's what God requires. It's first. He wants us to be good witnesses. That means we need to be seeking first his kingdom and his righteousness. In Matthew 10, Jesus gives instructions to his disciples that really spans the time between then, whenever that was, 29 AD, whenever that was written, all the way to the end. So let's just look at some of those verses. Jesus said, "Behold, I," Matthew 10, verse 16. Jesus said, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpents, harmless as doves, but beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. You'll be brought before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony, a witness to them and to the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, don't worry about how or what you will speak. It will be given to you in that hour what you should speak." So help will be available. "For it's not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. Now brother will deliver up brother to death, a father his child. Children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you'll be hated by all for my name's sake. But he who endures to the end will be saved. When they persecute you in this city," I suppose because of the witness you are giving, "flee to another. For assuredly, I say unto you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes." In time. "A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It's enough for a disciple that he be like his teacher, and a servant like his master. If they've called the master of the house Beelzebub, what will they call those of his household?" Verse 26, "Therefore, do not fear them. There is nothing covered that will not be revealed, nothing hidden that will not be known." So are we afraid of what lies ahead? Jesus says, you don't have to be afraid. There is no need to be afraid. Verse 27, "Whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light. And what you hear in the ear, preach on the housetops. Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul." So they cannot take away your life ultimately. That's in God's hands, no problem. "But rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." Hellfire, Gehenna fire. "Are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin? And not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will. The very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. Therefore, whoever confesses me before men, him will I also confess before my Father who is in heaven. Whoever denies me before men, him will I also deny before my Father who is in heaven. So once again, I believe we just need to be ready to be a good witness. Everything else is going to fall in place. Do you think John Moffat, when he is raised in his proper resurrection, which I believe probably the second resurrection, will say, I wish I had been somewhere else on that day in May in 1941. Why did I have to endure horrendous weather, being shot at by the biggest battleship in the world? Why couldn't have I had an office job back in London? He's not going to say that. He's going to be very happy. He was where he was. Do you think the men on Little Round Top, even the ones who lost their lives, maybe their limbs, when they are raised and given a vision of what their sacrifice meant to this nation and to God's plan for this nation, the descendants of Abraham, do you think they're going to say, why did I have to be born then? I think rather they're going to look back with some pride and satisfaction at what they did. Even the women of the South, who endured so much difficulty and sadness, when they're raised and they're given an understanding of what they helped to build out of rubble, the state and the nation that we live in, the state near where I live, the nation that you live in, will they say, why me? Why wasn't I born in Paris, France, to royalty? I don't think that's the way they're going to think. I think they're going to be happy enough for the role that they played in God's plan. Matthew 10, continuing on, verse 34, do not think I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who doesn't address his trials and tests like we heard about earlier is not worthy of me. And us, when we are raised in the first resurrection, are we going to say, why couldn't I have been a professional golfer, made millions of dollars, and not have to deal with the Sabbath or the holy days, not to mention that mess that came around at the end of the age and the confusion? That's not the way we're going to think. No matter what happens to us, that is not the way we're going to think. Verse 39, Matthew 10, he who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake will find it. Hopefully we're going to look back with satisfaction at how we led our lives, guided and motivated by the Spirit of God, that so few others had a chance to do. Our suffering will be forgotten, and it will have served a great purpose. Matthew 5, verse 14, you know these verses. We actually sang these verses earlier. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. So who knows, maybe you were born for a time like this. So one more verse. A member in North Carolina suggested I add this verse. I think that person really has a good point. So 2 Corinthians 3, verse 2. Paul writes, you are our epistle. You are our letter, written in our hearts and read by all men. Clearly, verse 3, you are an epistle of Christ, a letter of Jesus Christ, ministered by us, written not with ink, but by the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of flesh, that is, of the heart. A letter, brethren, written by Christ in us to be read by all who see. Hopefully that is happening in your life, because I do believe you believe that you were called for a time like this.